This is Culturetopia, a look back at all things cultural from your friends at National Public Radio. I'm Neda Ulibe, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Linda Holmes, writer and editor for NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
Every week, we bring you the best cultural coverage, from books and music to movies, television, and everything in between. And you can find links to all the stories we feature each week at npr.org/culturetopia.
This week, we'll look at a summer action thriller, a documentary about the food industry. We'll visit with blues legend Lonnie Brooks and hear from jazz pianist Dave Brubeck as he reflects on the anniversary of his classic song, Take Five. But first,
we're going to hear part of an interview with one of my favorite filmmakers, Guillermo del Toro. He's a Mexican filmmaker known as the Master of Magical Fantasy. He did Pan's Labyrinth and Hellboy and The Devil's Backbone. But since childhood, he's been obsessed with vampires. Now he's decided to try his hand at fiction writing with a new vampire novel called The Strain. He co-wrote it with Chuck Hogan, a veteran thriller writer, and he talked about it with NPR's Guy Raz.
The premise of this book is essentially that vampires have always been with us, but sort of now they're seizing the moment. They're about to take advantage of this opportunity, and they're going to start in Manhattan. Why did you set it in New York?
You know, it is the city that belongs. It's almost like the metropolis of all tales. You know, it takes the imagination of the entire world, and I also wanted to set it up against a background that is powerful, because the vampires in the novels, it's three of them that we're writing, they nest in places of great tragedy. I don't want to spoil anymore for anyone that hasn't read it, but
right.
You know, they are followed, they are tracked through history in places of enormous pain. And there is a very significant portion that takes place in the hollowed out areas beneath World Trade Center.
Now, vampire stories seem to have this kind of universal and endless appeal, and so many writers and movie makers have been able to come up with different scenarios for them. I mean, most recently, you know, sort of seeing vampires hanging out at shopping malls or going to the opera in tuxedos. But your vampires are real villains. I mean, they are really evil.
Well, they are actually just a parasitic, really brutal form of another living creature, and the killings and the drainings, so to speak, are not this warm feeling, like a almost orgasmic Barbara Cartland gothic romance beautiful moment. It is, you know, you turn into a Capri Sun container and these things are sucking you dry, and they are absolutely, this feeling of being vacuumed out of your life force is described as in brutal detail as we can.
Did you do that because, in a sense, you feel as if vampires have been portrayed as these kinds of kitschy and almost friendly caricatures of what they ought to be?
Well, I've been a very strange kid, and from the age 7 on, I've been 37 years, I've been deliberately putting together as minute a notebook about vampire biology and about vampire anatomy, and always thinking that the vampires that I was fascinated as a reader by were these monsters. They were not these romantic, decadent, existential bad boys.
I think people who are fans of your work, like Pan's Labyrinth and Hellboy, are going to be asking the question, when are you going to make this into a del Toro film?
I don't think I will. I really think we intended it as a long-form narrative, and maybe down the line we can try and adapt it into a graphic novel or cable series or something like that, but I would not try to compress them to a single film or something like that.
Now, you know, actually, he first wrote The Strain as a television treatment. Did you hear about this? And he submitted it to Fox.
Okay.
And Fox said to him, oh, we like it, it's good, we like you, but you need to make it funnier. And he said, I'd like my treatment back now, please, and I'm going to make it a book instead.
And Neda, for Monkey See, the blog that I edit, you were kind enough last week to...
Or indulged enough to...
Oh, not at all. You provided us with a live coverage of The Strain as you read it all in one day, gulped it down. Like it was coming out of a Capri Sun container, shall we say. So tell me about that experience. How did that go for you?
I'll tell you, Linda, I wouldn't do it again. And the reason why is just because I really wanted to be lost in the book and not setting it down every 15 minutes to try to recap the last 30 pages or so.
Right.
That said, I enjoy it. It's, you know, it's a hell of a beach read. And mm-hmm. if for Stephen King fans, you know, people who enjoy Stephen King will be pretty well satisfied by the book. I myself loved the first half of it. And then once things really sort of hit this bloody peak, I don't know, there's only so many vivisections and exsanguinations and so forth until they all start to sort of feel the same.
If you've seen one sucking of the blood, you've seen them all, as they say. We should also mention that you can hear more from Del Toro, including a great description of his home library, sort of a little hidey hole he has, you might say, where he's got it packed with all kinds of books of fairy tales and folklore. It's got comic books and film stuff and all kinds of marvelous nerd memorabilia.
I want to go to there.
And he talks about that in the rest of this interview, which is available at our website, npr.org.
We have another monstrous thing coming up, although in this case, it's a documentary called Food, Inc. And that might not sound particularly scary, but this movie has actually been described as doing to the supermarket what Jaws did to the beach. Food, Inc. takes aim at corporate giants behind the food supply and makes heroes out of unlikely characters like small-scale organic farmers who denounce big agribusiness. And NPR's Steve Inskeep spoke with director Robert Kenner and author Michael Pollan.
Now our food is coming from enormous assembly lines where the animals and the workers are being abused. And the food has become much more dangerous in ways that are being deliberately hidden from us.
Let's go through the clauses of that sentence, gentlemen. Our food is coming from enormous assembly lines, you say. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you want to see where your chicken comes from, it is huge, you know, the size of football fields, chicken houses, 40, 50,000 birds. They live a fraction of what their life was because now with the kind of pharmaceuticals we have, the kind of feed we have, the kind of breeding we've done, we've sped up their lives to the point where they develop these huge breasts in a couple weeks.
They get very fat, very fast.
They get very fat, and in fact, they can't really stand very well. Their legs cannot keep up with their breasts because we want to eat breast meat.
But it's across the board that our food has become industrialized. It's not only the chickens, it's the lettuce, and it's the tomatoes that we've figured out how to be very, very efficient in growing this food, but it's also not nearly as nutritious, and it comes at a high cost, as I say.
Marco Paulo?
Well, there's in a couple of ways. I mean, we've gotten really good, and we should acknowledge this achievement, that for less than you would earn at the minimum wage in America, you can walk into a fast food outlet and get thousands upon thousands of attractive calories. That is an achievement. I think it's just important that we recognize the cost. And one of the costs is safety. I mean, we have an epidemic of food-safe, foodborne illnesses. And it's not that we didn't ever have them. I mean, Aunt Mabel's potato salad has been killing people for generations, but it was contained because we had a decentralized system. Now, if you've got one hamburger grinding plant feeding millions of people in a week, and the average hamburger has material from 400 different cows in it, that if there is a problem in that system, it's a big national story.
I want to come to the next phrase in that sentence. You'd say that food is coming from enormous assembly lines and go on to say where the animals and workers are being abused. Now, you just talked about chickens. It sounds appalling, and the pictures are appalling. And yet I was thinking about it, even under the old system, aren't these chickens living a very short life and being killed anyway? I mean, do these things really make that much difference?
Their lives are about half as long as they once were, actually.
But as on Joel's farm, he said, my chickens, you know, every day of their life is a happy day except for their last day.
Oh, this is Joel Salatin, the organic farmer, not the industrial farmer.
Correct. On the industrial farm, these chickens basically, it's not a very pleasant existence. But I was as interested in the life of the workers who are processing this food. Vast majority of our food is both grown and processed by illegal immigrants because these are jobs most Americans don't want. And these people are the ones who are being arrested when the raids come, not the companies who are hiring them.
Well, that makes you a little hesitant about the big juicy steak you're planning on having later, I'll bet. And in other things that might make you a little bit nervous, the New York City subway is the setting for The Taking of Pelham 123, which is a big thriller coming out this summer with John Travolta as a terrorist type who hijacks a subway train. It's a remake, of course, of a really fantastically cool 1974 film of the same name, essentially, although it's interesting. It's 1, 2, 3, the words in the old one, and 1, 2, 3, the numbers in the new one. Don't know what they're getting at with that. At any rate, the New York City subway was the subject of a piece on Morning Edition this week where Laura Pellegrinelli reported on the image of the subway in the 1970s when the original movie was made, as opposed to its image now.
I like to kvetch as much as any New Yorker, but to be fair, the subway system has improved vastly since I was a kid in the 1970s. That's when the original taking of Pelham 123 was made. The classic stars Walter Matthau as Lieutenant Garber, a transit police officer faced with a hostage crisis on a hijacked train. Full of snappy one-liners, it captures old-school New York attitude as well as any film.
Hey, Frank, you're hogging all my circuits.
What do you want from me? I got motormen calling me from all over the line.
Well, tell them to shut up and get off the air. I need some more lines open here.
Pelham 123 came at a moment when the city was on the verge of bankruptcy, its infrastructure crumbling.
In the course of a normal work week, the average TA policeman deals with such crimes as robbery, assault, murder, drunkenness, illness, vandalism, mishigas, abusiveness, sexual molestation, exhibitionism.
The few times I rode the subway back then, I remember my mother tucking her modest jewelry into her blouse and turning her engagement ring around so the stone wouldn't show. Grandma always took the bus.
The worst aspect was the fear that people had in going down into the subways.
Ed Koch inherited a tough situation when he was elected New York City mayor in the mid-70s.
There was crime, although it was proportionately far less than in the streets. But nevertheless, because of the confined areas and you felt sort of trapped, the fear of crime was much greater being in the subways than on the streets of the city.
What happened?
Nothing happened,
lady.
Nobody
killed?
No, nobody's killed.
Graffiti also made the trains feel unsafe. Today we might call it art, but back then, graffiti was vandalism, plain and simple. It's conspicuously absent from the 1974 film. The subways did start to improve through attention to what are now called quality of life issues. The NYPD now handles security, and the Transit Command Center is state-of-the-art. In fact, it was a little too high-tech for director Tony Scott's crew, as they considered set design, says John Johnson, New York City Transit's chief transportation officer.
And they actually went and attempted to downplay what the existing control center looks like because they wanted to make it look real to the average eye as compared to we're pretty Star Trek-y up in the new control center now.
Even the subway cars are smarter and more efficient. In both movies, the hijackers disconnected a car and drove it on its own. But the modern operational systems would never allow that. Good to know, even if there's still a ways to go underground. For NPR News, I'm Lara Pellegrinelli in New York.
You know, we should mention there's also a very nice slideshow of the New York City subway that's also available on the site at NPR.org.
Blues man Lonnie Brooks grew up in a small Louisiana town listening to Cajun music while his grandfather picked the banjo. Later, he moved to Texas, where he teamed up with Clifton Chenier, one of the godfathers of Zydeco. Brooks and his son Wayne Brooks talked with Tell Me More's Michelle Martin and performed in front of a small studio audience.
Feel good doing right, but I feel much better doing wrong. Feel good doing right.
You know all of the other legends, you know, B.B. King, Eric Clapton, Buddy Guy. Do you think that our generation, Wayne's generation, you think we still get it? You think we still get the blues?
Yeah, everybody got the blues. If you can't get your food on time, you got the blues. You don't get your paycheck on time, you got the blues. Things don't happen right for you. You get angry. You get mad with somebody or something like that. That's blues.
Wayne, what do you think?
I think that a lot of, yeah, of course, everybody get the blues. They're sad, but I don't think they know exactly what it is. In dad's generation, they would call it the blue. You blue, man. You know, as far as my generation, a lot of them don't listen to blues. They listen to rap, R&B, soul, you know, the usual. That's what's on radio, and I believe that that's one of the main reasons why a lot of young people don't listen to blues or understand blues, is because it's not being played.
You and your brother, Ronnie Baker Brooks, are both in the business. Why do you think you still love this music? So many people your age are, as you said, more into rap or hip-hop.
Mainly because I was born around it. You know, listening to Dad's records, you know, Albert King, Chuck Berry, Muddy Waters. And I would watch him, you know, write songs. And we would help him write songs. You know, he would have me on Boxes and Spoons, you know, playing the beat. And Ronnie would play the bass line on the guitar. And he'd stay right there. Don't move. Don't move. Keep it right there. And I remember that I was like 6 years old. And I think that was a major impact.
It feel good doing right, but it feel better doing wrong.
From one musical icon to another.
NPR's Michelle Norris spoke with pianist Dave Brubeck about the 50th anniversary of his classic song Take Five from the 1959 album Time Out.
That's Take Five. The surprise jazz hit was recorded in 1959. It was surprising because it hit the pop charts, and it shook up the notion of rhythm in jazz. Only trained musicians might understand exactly what gave Take Five its flow. It was all in the time signature, five beats to the measure, a departure from more traditional 4/4 time in jazz. It was cutting edge and cool, a song millions would scoop up and savor. Take Five was recorded by the Dave Brubeck Quartet for Columbia Records. It was on an album called Time Out, a title that served as a double entendre. Those in the know knew it referenced the mood and the music's meter. The album also contained a tune called Blue Rondo a la Turk. Even non-jazz buffs are familiar with its melody. This is the golden anniversary year for the album Time Out, and to mark the occasion, there's a new 50th anniversary legacy edition of the recording. It includes a piano demonstration and a DVD of the making of Time Out. The pianist Dave Brubeck has slowed down at age 88, but he's still playing and writing music. He stopped by our studio this week, and we talked about that 1959 studio session for Time Out. He said his quartet was determined to come up with a new sound.
The president of Columbia Records said, after he heard Blue Rondo and Take Five, he said, "It's such a relief not to hear Body and Soul and Stardust. Every one of my artists play that every time they come into the studio. And what you're doing is so great." And then the sales force didn't want to put it out. They said, "Nobody can dance to these crazy time signatures, 9/8 and 5/4. He said, "But I'm going to be sure it goes out because I believe in it." And it became the biggest seller in jazz.
I want to talk to you about that 5/4 signature because it really was unique at the time. Everything in jazz was mainly 4/4 rhythm at that point.
Mainly 4/4, sometimes 3/4. But my drummer, Joe Morello, wanted to play in 5/4. That's how this piece came about. He wanted a drum solo. He wanted to do something different. A lot of other musicians never could play in five.
Why is it so difficult to play in the 5/4 time signature?
because you were brought up playing in 4/4. Everybody could walk to it and dance to it. Put an extra beat on that. Everybody's tripping.
In this case, people weren't tripping. They actually really enjoyed this. Why did Take Five become such a classic?
You know, the public demanded, after they heard it, and the disc jockeys said the board would be lighting up. What is that? What kind of song is that? It was grassroots that made that happen. And then it went around the world.
Can you tell me what that was like for you to travel across the country, to travel across the world and hear your music on the radio?
In those days, we were playing every night and driving after the job to the next job. And we'd start switching stations, and we'd be on one station after another.
You must have been very proud at that moment.
Oh, yeah. I'm a country boy, you know. I never expected anything like that.
What do you do to try to keep your hands nimble?
For me, the more you get to play, the better it is. Just play as much as you can while you can. I can't wait till the next job so we can play.
Well, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Michelle.
And for Brubeck enthusiasts, there's also a blog post on NPR's jazz blog, which is called A Blog Supreme, and it's spectacularly good, and I think everybody should be reading it. And they have a little post in there where they actually added they have some additional audio that was cut from the interview where Dave Brubeck talks about his work with Louis Armstrong, and there's also some music in it, and that's, if you are interested in Dave Brubeck, that will definitely be worth checking out as well.
Cool.
And that's all we have for this week. You can find links to all the stories we listened to today and subscribe to the podcast, if you haven't already, at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I'm Netta Ulipi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.